Hello and welcome to the Odd Job Pod. And I think it's fair to say we've been expecting you. Yes, indeed. We have a podcast which is, if you will, like a warm-up to an ongoing series of villainry. But really, it would be remiss to kick off our villainry series, which will culminate in a World Cup of Bond villains, much similar, although probably more sober than our previous World Cup of Bonds, which was a few months ago. But yeah, obviously, when you talk Bond villains, the first villain that pops into your head is Blofeld. I would like to, at this point, bring in my co-hosts, Terry DeFallon and Graham Sibley, neither of whom are dressed like Telly Savalas, or indeed in drag, like Charles Grey in Diamonds Are Forever. But both are very much looking forward to a spot of Blofelding. How are you, chaps?
A little bit intrigued by what Blofelding actually might be. It sounds filthy.
It does. It does sound like an entry into the Profanosaurus, doesn't it?
It does. I now wish I brought my drag costume.
Bright idea, Mr. Bond.
Yes, but wrong pussy.
And for which I'm sure the listeners are very glad that this is done by audio and there's no video at all at this stage. When we talk about Bond, the first villain that pops into everybody's head is inevitably Blofeld, part of the bigger Spectre organisation. And for much of the early Connery Bonds was the big bad, and obviously you have Telly Savalas, you have Donald Pleasence, you have Charles Grey, and then latterly Christoph Waltz in the Craig era as well. So before we kind of really try and dissect, if you will, those different different portrayals of Blofeld, let's kind of dive a little bit into what makes Blofeld such an iconic villain, that he is probably pretty much the most recognisable villain you can have in the Bond canon. Graham, where do you start? What for you makes Blofeld just such an effective and everlasting villain within the Bond series?
I think for me, it's only something I've done in later life by analysing it and looking at on across other genres as well, is that he's got that whole Moriarty thing, hasn't he? He's the whole thing about being behind everything that is evil in the world. And it's very, very nice and comforting for readers to know that there is a central source for all this, and it can be cut off and it can be defeated, rather than just being spread about and within every one of us. We've all got a little bit of evil inside of us, and some people obviously make money out of it. But the whole idea of Blofeld as someone who is the top of the tree and everything that is going on in the world somehow is in a web that he's in the middle of is, I think that's quite comforting for people. And I think that it gives people a nice world view that no matter what goes wrong in the world, it only needs some simple answers to sort it all out. And I think that's why, I mean, as well, what you have is, so you have this shadowy figure, because obviously in the purse parts of it, he is this scene in silhouette, isn't he? And he's just seen, well, from the chest down, stroking his pussy. Yeah, I thought I had to get that. I'll do that. I'd get that in now. You know, first 5 minutes of the podcast, get out of the way.
It's fine. We could have talked about Mrs. Slocum instead of that.
Of course. And then we get to see him. And actually, a lot of the mystery of him is taken away once we see him. Indeed, he loses a lot of his power once he turns his chair around. Oh, look, it's Donald Pleasence. He loses that power even more in the next film, and then gets it all back again with Telly Savalas. But and in the latest incarnation, we see the whole gamut of Blofeld as you see him from, well, being unveiled, and then you even get his backstory as well, which I'm sure we will come on to later.
Yes, his retconned backstory.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, for you, Terry, would you go along with what Graham said in terms of there is that kind of comfort knowing that there is a supervillain out there? And obviously it goes into a lot of typical narratives that we see elsewhere, that, you know, it's not just kind of one bit of randomness. There's always something behind that's playing the puppet master behind the throne. Yeah. Does that for you kind of feel why Blofeld's got such an enduring legacy? Because he was built up over a few films before suddenly unlike some villains just being parachuted in for one film and then disposed of.
Yeah, they had the benefit of having the character established in the books, obviously. I agree with Graham. He represents a way of looking at the world which is helps people to try and understand why all the bad stuff in the world happens, and that we put it down to an individual or an individual organisation, whereas in reality the world is very, very different to that and works very differently to that. But characters like Blofeld, characters like Moriarty, they're good ways of telling stories to explain the bad things that happen in the world and the evil that men do. And, you know, he and that type of character are an extremely valuable storytelling tool. And Blofeld is a very effective character, very well defined, particularly for me in the Ian Fleming novels from when I remember reading those, and also with the memorable performances on screen as well with Pleasance and particularly with Pleasance and with Savalas. But Christoph Waltz as well, also I thought was a splendid Blofeld, although, yeah, I unfortunately don't think he was served well by the movie.
I'm just sticking back with the effectiveness, and I'm glad you brought up the novels as well. One question that I was going to ask, which is always kind of, whenever I think of Blofeld, it's something that always for me kind of comes up, is how much he was a product of the time that he was written in, and especially when you look at the novels, and then you also look at that kind of representation of the Cold War and the thought, I suppose, you know, obviously a bit before my time and before all our times, really. But just to really kind of get the idea that there was always this shadowy person pulling the strings, probably, you know, from Russia or a Russia-esque country. And that kind of was always seemed to me about part of the enduring legacy as well, that it was understood a little bit in terms of the narrative of the world at the time as well. Don't know what you feel about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because, I mean, the thing about Blofeld and the thing about Spectre is it's an international organisation. It's not tied to one specific nation. And those books written, you know, in the post-war era, after an extremely traumatic, very, very bloody, horrific war. And I suppose Fleming, by not tying Blofeld to a particular nation state, maybe was he... providing some kind of relief for the reader so as that they don't get themselves embroiled while reading the story in national or international politics, and more portraying Blofeld as a criminal rather than a politician. I don't know whether or not he is a criminal. Well, I suppose he is, but I mean, what is he? Is he a terrorist? I mean, it's difficult to. I mean, terror is part of the Spectre brief. It's in the name, but
he is. But I think what he really is a perfect amalgamation for a changing world, because you can reinvent him to whatever he needs to be.
Yes,
those little meetings he has with all his little numbered minions around the tables. What they're talking about doesn't really change. I mean, like in Spectre, they were going talking about people trafficking, wasn't it?
Yes.
And there's also lots of references to drugs and lots of sort of gangster type things.
Yeah.
And basically criminal things that have been around forever.
But also extortion and blackmail and things like that. Blackmailing officials.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's those sort of things that never go away. Now, if he'd had been just like General Blofeld
of the Soviet Union,
he would have suddenly become an anachronism, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He'd just be lost now, wouldn't he? He'd come back as a good guy now, wouldn't he?
He could well be reinvented as a good guy.
And that's why, I mean, like...
Fortunately, that's out of the question, isn't it?
Yes.
I think so.
Well, I don't know. Is General Gogol someone going to be?
General Gogol was never genuinely a bad guy.
He was brought in as part of the softening of relationships.
Wasn't it? It's funny, isn't it? Because it's a slight diversion, but the Soviet Union features quite a lot in From Russia with Love, but not as the principal antagonist.
No,
they're set up as being the principal antagonist by Spectre, but actually they're not.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, it's similar with The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and I think with a lot of sort of like spy genre movies in that era, is that they were not anxious to point the finger at the Soviet Union, because they were actually at the time the enemy and we totally could have gone to war with them. So they probably were quite keen to keep them out of these kind of fictionalized accounts of adventure stories. So I think it's interesting that this is obviously a decision that creators at the time felt was the wise thing to do.
Mm.
Fleming felt it was the wise thing to do. And so he constructed Spectre and Blofeld, if you like, to put them in there and just make them wholly evil. The Soviet Union only started coming into Bond films, for example, from Russia with Love. But even then, that was when it was détente and there was this reconciliation. So
Is also the thing in the mid-60s is where a lot of the big things that were happening in there, like the like Cuba, Vietnam, the anti-apartheid movement, a lot of that was being funded by the Soviet Union and China. So although there wasn't direct involvement from those powers, there was money going in there, and there was money and support.
Proxy wars, weren't they?
Yeah, basically. So, and this gives you the idea of the fact that you don't need to actually have a huge army and be fighting on a battlefield. Mm. You can be controlling things just by
with your many tentacles
putting your resources out there and making that. And I suppose that gives the idea of Spectre, the fact that and now we're seeing that as now state-sponsored cyber terrorism and things like that we're seeing a world that is actually getting closer to
totally foreshadowing all of this the internationalization of crime and terror and extortion. I mean, very, very, very prescient and good thinking on Fleming's part, and translating very effectively onto screen in the movies in places.
I think that for me is part of why it does endure as well, because again, it's not just that easily understood in terms of good versus bad, but it is understood in terms of the kind of world. But also, again, to bring back to another one, a point that was raised quite early on in the podcast, which was the fact that when you first see Blofeld, actually, it's Donald Pleasance, and he puts in a fine performance. But I always feel the moment you have that reveal, he loses something. And I was quite fortunate in the way that I watched the Bond films, in that I think I remember definitely watching You Only Live Twice after I'd watched From Russia with Love and Thunderball. I'd watched those a couple of times before I then got round to You Only Live Twice. It was one of the later films I'd watched. So I kind of got a little bit of the kind of surprise of seeing a Blofeld for the first time. And then a little bit of disappointment as well. And it's funny because I've always felt that Blofeld is a wonderful villain. But for me, it always feels like he's actually more effective when he's not on screen than when he is on screen.
Yeah, the thought of him is much better than the actual than him, because I mean, that's easy to explain, isn't it? Because you know, he builds up such a mystique, and yet really, at the end of the day, he's still just a normal human being like everyone else.
Mm. I think Pleasance was a fine actor.
Yes,
but I'm afraid I agree. I'm always disappointed with Donald Pleasance's performance. It's nothing to do with him, but I just think it is because of that. I think because Blofeld worked so well in the shadows, and that when he emerges, he's just this rather diminutive, bald man with an unlikely-looking cat. I mean, I don't think the look has aged well as well, in truth. I think I'm trying to think back to the first time I ever saw Donald Pleasance's Blofeld, and I think it would have been when I was watching it on ITV. Watching You Only Live Twice on ITV as a nipper, probably with my parents. And I remember seeing him, and I remember the scar. And I have to say, I mean, this would have been in the 1980s. So, you know, still some time after the movie had been made. And I have to say that I think I remember being quite unconvinced by the scar and by the look. I felt the Nehru jacket, which I think is magnificent now.
Yeah.
But I think was ill-fitting. I think it was a poorly tailored outfit. I've got to be honest, I just don't think that he just carried it off with the panache that I think that you would have expected. Maybe that's one of the reasons why You Only Live Twice is not a celebrated movie. But it's funny because he's held up as being the definitive Blofeld.
Well, according to our listeners,
we did a poll recently he came out there as such. But it's difficult to square off, really. But I mean, as we've said on this podcast before, and we'll say again,
you know,
I think the consensus amongst us is that Telly Savalas puts in the best performance, but perhaps he's aided by the fact that he's also in the strongest movie as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the thing is with Pleasance's depiction of him, yes, we get the look, we get the feel, but we only get the look. We don't really get the feel. Mm. We don't get any of the nuance that Fleming gave the character.
Mm.
All you've got is you've got this little man who obviously can't stand up to Bond face to face.
No.
Yeah, and really doesn't look like he is capable of commanding a global operation.
Yeah, I mean, the character being very clever and very devious and very manipulative and clearly commanding huge resources. So he's a very, very good administrator. But there's a charisma that's just simply like you just can't see him commanding armies.
No.
I mean, it just doesn't work. I mean, there are plenty of little generals.
Yes.
Napoleon being a fine example, for example, but he just doesn't strike you as having that kind of charisma. His accent's cheesy but much of this unfortunately is bound up with postmodern conceptions of Blofeld and of course here we go, Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Of course and it's very difficult to separate that from, you know, what it would have been like to have watched that at the time when it came out, and I would imagine the audience reaction would have been entirely different to ours. And I find it incredibly difficult to separate my postmodern perception of Pleasance's Blofeld with the actual Pleasance Blofeld.
Well, I mean, of course, what does make a difference, and we return to this fact over and over again, is that these films weren't meant to be seen.
No, no. They were only meant to be seen at the theatre.
Yeah, they were only meant to be seen at the cinema. You're only going to see these episodes once every year or so.
Mm.
And then you were hardly going to see them again.
Yeah.
And then along comes, TV starts showing them every Christmas. And then you get video box sets.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing them in a completely different way. And as Gary says, you're seeing them, you may not see them in the right order. The right, in inverted commas, there, order. And then it all of a sudden, what you'll see, you can't watch the Bond films like you would a series of like a season one of The Sopranos. It's not like that, is it? There's no arc there.
No,
it's not designed to be seen that way. But because of the episodic nature of at least the Blofeld arc anyway.
Mm.
Then you feel like you can watch it like that and have that build up of a story, but of course, you know, that's problematic and it does have problems, and this is why there are problems with Blofeld and the way he's portrayed and the fact they get a different actor for him every time.
Yes, I think I quite like the fact that they did that.
Yeah,
I don't know how I would have felt if Donald Pleasance had turned up in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah.
Because largely, I think Telly Savalas just did such an amazing job.
Oh, yeah.
Very
certainly.
Different Blofeld.
Yeah.
I always found Telly Savalas as well just that little bit more sinister than I think any of the other Blofelds as well. And when you look at kind of the performances that are in, and then when you look up against other villains as well, I look at Telly Savalas' Blofeld and I go, actually, out of everybody you talk about, he's got that creepiness to him. He's got that level of sinisterness that actually Donald Pleasance is missing because he feels a little bit more over the top.
Mm.
He's definitely missing in Charles Grey for Diamonds Are Forever, which I like Charles Grey. I think he's a fantastic actor, and I think he did a very good job as Bond, as Blofeld, but was just hampered with an appalling script and a very, very bad film.
Yeah.
And then Christoph Waltz's Blofeld, I felt they were trying to cram too much into one go, and there was a lot of ends that they were trying to tie up that didn't really need to be tied up.
Yeah.
And the way that he was put together, he started off as almost Bond Blofeld in a nutshell. He started off very sinister and then just became a little bit more cartoon-like as he went through. But for me, it's that kind of just that that slight uncomfortableness that you have when Telly Savalas is on the screen, because he just gets under your skin a little bit, and he's quietly menacing, and you do feel that he is the kind of person that actually could just click his fingers and something would happen and you'd be gone. Whereas, you know, Pleasance, it is press a button and you drop into a shark-infested water. And as Terry said at the time, that might have seemed genuinely quite shocking and surprising on screen. But now, with the kind of, you know, benefit or otherwise of rewatching Bonds again and again and again, it becomes one of the biggest cliches of a Bond, of a Bond film in Blofeld. But in the case of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and when you think of all the other Bond villains, actually, Savalas's Blofeld is the only one that I think I'd put up there with the other really good quality villains that just have that ability to just slightly unsettle you in a way that that perhaps the poorer Bond villains don't do, because they don't have that believability of just either they're a match for Bond physically or they are just genuinely quite creepy, unpleasant people.
Yeah. He has that ruthlessness of Zorin.
Yeah.
But he also he has the physicality and the dynamism of Trevelyan.
Yeah.
And portrayed by a brilliant actor.
Well, this is the point. I mean, you're actually in a period where you get a lot of good actors who really can nail that whole sense of malevolence straight away. I mean, you look at the films that come afterwards, right, apart from Diamonds Are Forever, but you've got Yaphet Kotto, who I think is really does bring across that sense of malevolence. And of course you've got Christopher Lee, Scaramanga.
Mm. Yeah.
And
all very powerful men.
Yeah.
And capable of exuding brutality.
Yeah.
And savagery. And and even when they're not being savage, it's always there.
Even when they're all like in their suits and boots and trying to be to be like part of an establishment or building themselves up as a leader and things like that. You can still, I think the difference with the Mr. Big and Scaramanga is of course that they're still underneath it, they're still quite brutal. And with Blofeld is that he's almost pulled himself away from that, and when he does it, it's because, you know, this is all part of the job.
Yeah, I mean, they don't go too much on the screens apart from in Spectre. They don't go too much into the backstory. So Savalas is Blofeld, Pleasance is Blofeld. There's not much in the way of backstory about where they came from and how they came to be. The villains that you refer to, Scaramanga and Mr. Big, there's a degree of backstory about them explaining the origins of the why they are who they are. And we don't really know too much about where Blofeld is. So for all we know, he could have come from a privileged background and is just a genuinely evil and savage man. There's no real sort of like explanation as to why. The other thing I think that works so well about Savalas's Blofeld, which is nothing to do with Pleasance and not Pleasance's fault, is that Blofeld has so many other things to do in this film. You know, he's in a lab. You only see him sat behind a desk holding that cat once, and in fact, he's in the process of putting that cat down to go off and do something.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of scenes, very brief scenes, in which he sat there with the cat just to really tell the audience that this is the same guy as you saw in the previous movie. This is Blofeld. It's a visual cue for the audience. But really, he's skiing down mountains. He's up, you know, on Peace Gloria. He's making threatening barbed, he's talking to that guy who he's about to actually have killed because he's been climbing up his mountain, you know, on the top there. You know, and you know that exchange with Bond about, you know, where he's smoking that fag in the odd way, and all of that, he has such a variety and diversity of scenes, including at the end with Tracy.
Yes.
That there's just so much more range and depth to the character, and all that Donald Pleasance does is just really sit behind the desk giving orders in a kind of reedy, sort of cheesy, you know, accent. And
kill Bond. Now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's a goodbye, Mr. Bond. And you can't take that seriously, unfortunately. And it is a real shame, but it is a fact as well.
Graham, how much do you think of that kind of what we've just talked about is down to perhaps the failings of the script writers rather than the characters themselves. Because if you look, as Terry said, if you look in on A Majesty's Secret Service, there is a bit more depth, but you can still portray depth to a kind of character who does turn up quite late in a film, or is that kind, or a villain that doesn't necessarily have like too much to do in there. Or you can give them a bit of, you can give them a bit more malevolence or what have you. I'm thinking, for example, well, it's a dreadful film. A film like The World Is Not Enough, where actually Robert Carlyle isn't in it very much, but still manages to convey an awful lot. You kind of really get a sense of the character and just that level of kind of evilness within there. Whereas you've got this kind of, these two films either side, where Blofeld is beaten, and in one case, he's beaten in a very over-the-top way in You Only Live Twice. And then in Diamonds Are Forever, he's beaten in a way which is just
daft.
Bad comedy. Hmm. But then at the end of On a Majesty's Secret Service, you've got a very brave decision to write in an end, you know, stick to the ending of the book and write in an ending where actually the villain ends on the upper hand rather than the hero. And for me, a lot of it, I think, you can have a slightly weak villain at times, but they can still be redeemed by a pretty decent script. Whereas you can have a good villain, but no matter how good they are, if the script isn't right, they will always be a little bit diminished off the back of that.
I think, well, it is something that all filmmakers have got a problem with, though, is when you have a villain, do you make them the star of the film? Especially if you're in a franchise film like Bond, where obviously people go to see Bond, and obviously your Bond actor is, I wouldn't say precious, but obviously we'll assume that he is the star of the film. And when you, I think when you do say, I mean, Robert Carlyle's a really, really good example because he was hideously underused in that film. But Sophie Marceau was used really well.
Mm.
And really, when you think, if you built up Robert Carlyle's role anymore, all of a sudden you've got Pierce Brosnan trying to hold himself up against these two,
mm-hmm.
and he all of a sudden he's going to be like merging into the background. Roger Moore had that when he was well, the Roger Moore and Christopher Lee scene where they're sat around the table is one of the best in Bond. I love it. It's often quoted, and rightly so. It's a really, really good scene, and I always go back to it. But you see, in his last film, you've got him going up against Christopher Walken, and Christopher Walken's methoding it up, going there and everything. And he's got such lovely screen presence, and he's at the peak of his powers, Walken, at the time.
Mm.
And it's very difficult to say, well, how can you bring him more into the film and going up against Roger? The scenes that he's in there with, they're unbalanced, and they're a bit funny, they're a bit weird, and that sums up that film all the way through. Really, it's unbalanced and weird, and you know, that's not Roger's problem. That's the problem with the filmmakers. They've just put together a load of funny ingredients in it, and they've come up with this, well, it's workable film, but it's not perfect by any means.
No.
There's a good question point I think you actually potentially raised there, in that you look at the other Bonds, and they're going up against other Blofelds. They're going up against a very strong Bond, whereas you've got somebody like Telly Savalas, who's counterpoint to George Lazenby.
Mm.
Who is new into the role. Obviously, you know, I we've talked about this before, how, you know, we love the job that he's done, but he is limited in what he can do in his range. So when he's up against, on screen with Diana Rigg, and when he's on screen with Telly Savalas, naturally the actors who can play up a bit more come across a little bit stronger. So there's a combination of elements for me in that film that just make that Blofeld a little bit stronger. And you do wonder, you know, even if there'd been a different actor, I maybe say if they brought Charles Gray in for that one, okay, it would have been a different film, but you still would have a very strong actor going up against an actor who is better for screen presence, I would sort of argue, in Lazenby, rather than, you know, delivery of lines and acting in itself.
Mm. Yeah, I think you can see that straight away. I mean, you can see that if you're directing that film, you're going to get Diana Rigg and Telly Savalas on there as much as you yes. possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, for me, I mean, they probably are in truth the stars of the show.
Yeah,
and I say that as someone who has, you know, vigorously defended George Lazenby.
Well, you did on this podcast.
Indeed, yeah. On this podcast, I spent 45 minutes doing it, and I'm not about to start all over again doing that. But it is a fact that he was an inexperienced actor, and Telly Savalas and Diana Rigg were outstanding
yeah.
actors are and were outstanding actors. So naturally, they dominated proceedings and were the stars of the show. Probably one of the elements that made the film so good. What you were just talking about earlier, Gary, chimes in nicely with Charles Grey, because here is an outstanding actor, perhaps from a hammier age, very much a scenery chewer of the old school, and I don't think that. I don't know whether or not his character Blofeld would have necessarily held up in a better film anyway, because it is a little bit cheesy. But nevertheless, here is a fine actor who I think could have adapted very nicely to, say, a Blofeld on Her Majesty's Secret Service. I mean, if Telly Savalas hadn't been available and they cast Charles Grey, I think he would have done a fine job. I don't think it would have been as good, but I think he would have done a fine job. But he was served by, I think, a poor film. Although it is worth just interjecting here and saying that we do have defenders of Diamonds Are Forever among our listeners. We've been contacted on Twitter by one individual who's a big fan of Diamonds Are Forever and won't hear this nonsense that it's a bad film.
Wow, right, okay.
So fair play to you.
Fair play to his wrong opinions.
To his wrong opinions, yeah. But, I mean, I think that there's some moments in Diamonds Are Forever which work extremely well, particularly on the oil rig. There's some moments where he seems to, you know, work quite well when he's, but only.
Had to be showing a little bit more cheek than usual.
I'm not referring to those moments, but unfortunately, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's things like that which completely overshadow his yeah. his performance. And yeah, I mean, the fact that he's in drag as well. I mean, you know, there is nothing wrong with men wearing women's clothes. May I just say that, as the boot of my car will attest. But it just didn't work. That scene just didn't work. Unfortunately, no. It wasn't funny, and it just cheapened and undermined this character, I think, by introducing comedy moments.
I don't think you have to worry. I don't think Charles Grey turning up in drag in there was in any way empowering to people who like to cross dress.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm offending anybody by saying this. It was just bad.
I think only about 30% of our listeners will probably take exception to it, but that's
a small number. That's a small number. We could ask how many of our listeners cross-dress. I'll stick a poll up on Twitter in a moment.
You do that.
Answer honestly, listeners. Answer honestly.
and the full deal. No. Just, well, I do wear my girlfriend's panties occasionally.
There's probably an entire group of transgender listeners that we've just completely alienated we never knew were there.
No.
So, sorry about that.
I think it takes Bond into some slightly weird areas. It almost feels like we're crossing into an area of fan fiction that exists on the corner of the internet that I haven't yet stumbled across at any rate.
I'll send you some links.
this is what I love about this podcast, because you and me sat here and then all of a sudden like we just hand it back to Gary, so there you go, off you go. what's next, Gary?
What you do from that is you take a break, like the Bond franchise did from Blofeld, apart from when he popped up very briefly to be chopped down the chimney in the Moore era, as their way of definitively killing off any link with Blofeld. And obviously regular listeners and fans will know of the various contractual situations during the Moore era. But then you have this kind of build up to Blofeld in Inspector, which I think we all knew was going to come eventually. Now, I'm I remember, obviously, the three of us watched Spectre at the cinema together, and I remember coming out of it thinking, that was a brilliant film. And then I watched it again and went, it starts not to hold up quite as much on second viewings. And I realized that part of that was, again, I'm a huge fan of Christoph Waltz. I really love some of his performances, especially in the Tarantino films. He's fantastic in Inglourious Basterds, and he's fantastic in Django Unchained as well. And you know that when you saw his name, you got very excited. And for me, I think he was partly let down by the script. One, because he had a very short amount of time to try and cram in the whole range of Blofeld, from sinister to completely defeated in what almost felt like a slightly comedy way. But the thing that I really, I think, kind of had a slight problem with the Blofeld-ness of Spectre was the fact that it tried to cram in every single element of the Craig films up until that point, all tied back up into Blofeld. And that, to me, was, you know, it's fine for... It made sense in Casino Royale because we know what the Schiffer is. He's, you know, he's a banker for Spectre. So in essence, he kind of made sense. And Quantum of Solace, as we've talked about before, is a film that kind of meandered a little bit and was trying to bring in the idea of Spectre, albeit under a different name. But again, you could see that shadowy pulling around. But yet Skyfall feels like a film that is slightly out of step. We're trying to cram Silver into it. He seems like he doesn't need that. He doesn't need to be part of it. And I think that's where it kind of felt like it was a bit of a kind of tonal jump for me, that I could just about start drawing the dots up until one point. And then I think my brain stopped the second time I watched it and went, so hang on, I've got to start tangling back to that, to the connection there. And then suddenly I went, hang on, there feels like there's a lot that's being crammed in. And when I went back and watched it a third time, not that it's ever recommended to overanalyze Bond, but I felt that there were a lot of holes that were picked with Blofeld, and he just, again, he didn't have that level of sinisterness that, say, Javier Bardem and Mads Mikkelsen brought in earlier roles for me.
I think you're spot on there. It does fail, that film, because it does try and shoehorn everything that's gone on before, try to make it all make sense. And you know, the last thing you do with a Bond film is trying to make it make sense.
There's no need for it.
There's no need. You go away from it and say, you walk away from it and like let someone else clean up the rubble.
I mean, James Bond is best when it's an anthology and just forget about what happened in the last film.
Yeah.
I mean, pick out the bits that you want to bring forward and leave the rest behind. Yeah. Don't worry about it. But we don't live in those time anymore. Fans and audiences expect continuity. And you know, I look forward to the day when they no longer expect continuity. But I mean, we're all suffering from Game of Thrones syndrome. You know, everything must be like stitched together. And it's like, why can't you just tell a James Bond story? Just do that. The Spectre's problem is that it's the pacing is completely wrong. Completely wrong. The first part of the movie just meanders along too slowly. And then we get to finally where we get to meet Blofeld properly. You know, they were rushing through it all. And as you say, Gary, they then take the decision to retcon all the previous Craig movies and drop it in there.
Including Quantum of Solace, which basically Spectre is a remake of.
Yeah, the whole idea of Quantum was that, like, we haven't got Spectre, so we're going to have to come up with a Spectre equivalent, so that's fine. And then they end up getting Spectre, so then they have to bring all of that in. And you just think, well, I mean, there's some truly memorable scenes in Spectre. Individual scenes in there, but it's pacing that it takes them too long to get to Blofeld, and then there's also a false climax as well, which is always something that I personally struggle with. Until you get to the end, and then, you know, I mean, things like they insisted on the visual cues, they insisted on the Nehru jacket, you know, and they insisted on the scar, and then you're just thinking, you know, yeah, you're dressing this guy up. This guy's turned up for a fancy dress party as Blofeld. And then at that point, I'm checked out by that point, unfortunately.
It's almost as if they've made a prequel here.
Yes.
as well, because actually, don't worry though, the proper Blofeld will be in the next film. And
yeah,
it's like,
but I don't know whether he's coming back.
No,
though. There's no talk that Valtz will be coming back.
No.
And he is one of the great actors of our age, Christoph Valtz. I was delighted when we got him. I mean, he is the equal of Bardem as an actor, in my opinion. And it's a tragedy that he was just ended up by the end of it, he was just in a fancy dress costume. And I think that's a real tragedy of that movie and of the character. Keep him out of that Nehru collar is the thing for future Blofelds.
So to sum up, as we kind of, I guess, take that Blofeldness in there, where if you kind of had a final parting thought in where Blofeld fits and whether they've got him right, do you think that he actually, do we both, you think he deserves that status as an iconic villain, or that he actually, you know, you just happen to have this kind of great idea of the shadowy figure, but actually the reality isn't quite there when you try and put all the Blofeld films together.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
The fact is he is the main protagonist.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Whether
I mean,
he deserves to be or not, he is.
Yeah, he is the Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
Isn't he? And going back to the Moriarty
thing,
he's
there. But he has been poorly portrayed.
Yeah.
And he has been well portrayed. And he'll, I assume, be poorly and well portrayed in the future.
But as well, like Moriarty and Lex Luthor, two characters that are difficult to handle in film representations.
Yep.
Because every time that you get a new person playing those characters, you get someone else who comes along and reinterprets the villain as well. So you've not only got someone reinterpreting the lead character, you're also reinterpreting the protagonist as well, which obviously moves through time.
And for the record, Gene Hackman was the best Lex Luthor.
Yes, yes. Well, it certainly isn't Kevin Spacey, let's face
certainly
it.
Isn't, good God, no. Not now,
it
anyway.
Can't be now, anyway.
No. Well, it never was, truthfully. No, that's a fact. That's not an opinion.
Take that
to the
fact bank.
Bank, truly banked in the bank of facts in there. And I'll also just add in that I very much enjoyed Andrew Scott's Moriarty as well, in even if the rest of Sherlock got a bit confusing. He did a wonderful job as Moriarty, and obviously did a wonderful job in Spectre as well. Turned up and was a wrong on that as well. So I think do you feel we've kind of teased people up to get their villainry glands salivating, as it were, for the next set of epic villainry that we've got coming up, where, you know, over the course of the next few podcasts, we will be looking in exploring villainries. And, you know, much like we did in ranking the Bond films with a good World Cup, because we also love a good World Cup as well. And now's as good a point as any to mention the football crossover of the pod that Tamer and Graham do. If you haven't come across it by now, I'm very, very, very surprised in their Sound of Football. But we know you guys love a good World Cup. So let's put it together and let's see who comes up best, and we'd love to know what the listeners think on there. And I think there's much more that we can talk about even without ranking Bond villains. I think there's much more mileage in looking at villainry, both good, epic, and also particularly poor as well. I have a feeling who I think might be our listeners' least favourite villain across the entire Bond canon. I'll be interesting to see what kind of responses we get back from any listeners as to between now and the next podcast as to who they rank as the worst of the Bond villains, because I have an idea in my mind who I think it might well be.
Well,
bad.
We'll find out soon enough, but
there will be Twitter polls, there will be other much more as well. But for now, Terry and Graham, thank you for Blofelding for this podcast. We will be back with more villainry to come. As ever, you can check us out on Twitter, our job pod, Facebook as well. Please do subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you really, really, really like us, or particularly hate us the other way, but preferably like us, do leave a comment as well. But as they say, the Odd Job Pod will be back next time, and we'll be back for more super villainry. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
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 Goodbye.